Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at Charlie Chaplin and his 1931 classic, City Lights. Returning on the show today to talk about City Lights, Professor Marie Wester. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So this is just one of those movies I would just rank like top 10, top 20 of all time. It's like one of those great, it's a great balancing of drama and comedy, and it really gives you that also that tear-jerking ending.
Yeah, this is one of my all-time favorite movies, and it's my favorite Chaplin movie. It's a lot of people's favorite Chaplin movie, and favorite movie was Orson Welles' favorite movie.
Yeah, and when you look at it, it's just you go down the line of all the anybody who's big, famous film director, they all just rank this as one of their all-time favorites. Like, even like somebody like Fellini says it's his all-time favorite.
Yeah, know? It's got a lot going for it. It's a great story in there.
Yeah, just, you know, once again, it's that ending, you know, it's like if that doesn't get you a little bit moved and a little, even just a tiny bit of water in your eyes, just like, I don't know what I can do for you. Just the whole building up of what he does and that great line reading at the end, it just hits you right in the spot.
It really does. And Chaplin himself said this was his favorite film and that ending close-up was his favorite shot ever, because he thought it was just, it really summed up the character's feeling without being too sentimental or mawkish.
And it really highlights how Chaplin can do dramedies well. Like, he can give you the slapstick, which you want, where you know, he has like these great scenes. Of the best scene is the boxing sequence when he's,
I love that sequence,
constantly trying to, you know, walking around. It's a classic scene. And you got that, but he still always manages to throw in some, you know, always in all of his movies, whether it's this, whether it's Modern Times, whether it's The Great Dictator or Limelight, he's always able to throw in like some sort of emotional tale that really gets you. And it doesn't get too like cheesy or cliche. Like, there's all, it feels really good or natural, I guess.
It does. And his character, you know, the tramp is always the underdog, so of course you always feel for him. But this is a real personal story. You know, you really feel like he falls in love with the girl, just the way he treats the flower she gives him. You know, he won't leave it behind. He goes back for it. He just, it symbolizes so much.
Yeah, and what he goes through to get that operation for her, which leads to great comedic events. But, you know,
a series of fabulous, fabulous sight gags. And, you know, everything's a little bit underplayed. You know, like there's the scene where he's shoveling horse manure. And then it ends with an elephant walking down the street and he just sort of gives up. Yeah. But they don't show any more of that. You'd have to put, you know, the rest of the gag together.
And even like I said, he goes to the boxing match. He has to go through prison because he gets framed for the robbery. And he keeps having to talk to this drunk guy who only remembers him when he's drunk. But when he's sober, he's like, who the heck is this guy? He goes through so much to get, you know, make sure she gets this operation.
Now, people say that the blind girl is symbolic of his mother and the billionaire is symbolic of his father.
That's interesting because, knowing Chaplin's backstory, for those who don't know, his mother was a vaudeville performer, and I believe she was taken away to a
loony bin
asylum. Yeah, and so he's always had this. I believe, like around this time, she passed away. I believe she passed away. So yeah, he's always had these movies where he always tries to, you know, have something of his mother in the characters.
The whole gag with the millionaire changed because at first it was going to be two millionaires who pick up the tramp at the city dump, take him out on the town, you know, show him a really good time, and then return him to the dump. And he wakes up the next day and doesn't know if it was a dream. Instead, it turns into this millionaire who only recognizes him when he's drunk.
Yeah, which is always perfect because at the beginning of the movie, the millionaire's fed up and he's going to throw himself in the river, which leads to this, of course, this great set where you know, Chaplin keeps trying to stop him, and he keeps falling in the river, then he falls in, and they keep falling in at the same time.
And it works on a lot of levels, too, because of, you know, the careful way it's set up, because the blind girl's grandmother certainly is not blind, and he always ends up coming over when the grandmother's not around. I mean, that would have ended the whole story, because she would have been able to see that he was not a rich man and would have told her niece that, or her granddaughter that.
And I even remember watching the Robert Downey Jr. Charlie Chaplin biopic, and they were showing that part where he's making City Lights, and he's like, how are we going to convey the fact that she thinks he's rich?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this, you know, it's a perfect, just a tiny little setup when he's talking to her, and then he leaves. At the same time, there's this rich guy doing something, and the door shuts. And so she thinks he got in that car and left. So that's what, in her mind, she's thinking he's this rich guy, and that's how he's going to be able to pay for the operation.
Actually, he crawls through the rich man's car, evading some sort of caper.
Oh, yeah.
And then that door slams, and she looks up thinking that a car door is shut and he's rich. And then when the real guy gets in the car and leaves, she thinks he has left. Yeah, it's a great way to get that across. But he's shot that scene 342 times.
Wow.
Because he couldn't figure out how to make it obvious that the blind girl mistakenly thinks he's rich until he landed on the idea of the car door.
Yeah, and like, this is such a film, I think, that just everyone can enjoy. Like, we were talking just earlier before the show when you talked about how kids in your class really liked My Name is Khan, and I just rolled my eyes so hard at that movie because it's so cheesy and manipulative. Like, this is a movie I think anybody can enjoy. I don't find this movie cheesy or manipulative at all. And I think even if you're really into film, you've been into it for a long time, or you just kind of watch it for kicks or whatever, this is the movie for you. It's like, it'd be a perfect date movie because everyone has something for it.
Yeah, and it has a light touch with all of the humor that it uses. And some of the stuff you've seen show up in like Tom and Jerry, like the old switch out the soap for the sandwich gag.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the person starts, you know, bubbling up with suds. But a lot of his gags are like that. And you can sort of see this would be perfect for a cartoon.
Yeah, and there's so many great gags in this movie. And I think even like you said, the boxing match is one of my favorites. The beginning gag with the statue, where it's this big, they're really, you know, relying on the pomp and circumstance of this, you know, unveiling of the statue. And here he is, he's sleeping on it. on it. Every time he tries to get off, he's like,
it gets worse.
His pants are stuck on it, so he can't get off. And then then they have to play the national anthem, and so he's like standing up, but he's still trying to hold his pants because his pants are falling down.
Yeah, classic slapstick. But you know that wah-wah voice that they use, which makes me think of Peanuts all the time. That's actually Chaplin doing that voice. So this really is Chaplin speaking in his first speaking part.
And that's the thing is, this is such a great silent movie, but what's so amazing about this film, this was released in 1931. By 1930, every film was a talkie. There was no, the silent era was, by 1930, was basically dead. And so this is a guy who, you know, I think at this time people were saying, well, you should do talking pictures, you should do talkies. And he says, no, I still want to do a silent movie. And it's amazing that this film was such a huge hit, even after the end of the silent era, where he could still do what he wanted and still make it silent, and people will still enjoy it.
Well, he ponied up his own too, $1.5 million, which is pretty expensive. It's expensive now, so he could have his way. And he hired a whole bunch of extras to do that boxing scene, which was apparently like party day on the set, because they had all these people and everybody was having such a great time. And they did it over several days and everybody kept hearing about it, so they kept getting more and more extras.
Extras. It just shows how, like you talked about the money, like I don't think there's ever been somebody as far as who had that much power influence on his movies than Chaplin did. We talk about, you know, people like, I don't know, a Spielberg or a Kubrick or a Fincher, who were like, you know, these really meticulous guys who, every tiny, even the tiniest little, almost insignificant aspects of their film, they want control of, or even Hitchcock. But still, they never had it as much as Chaplin did, because he really was, like, of the first film star.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 1914, he became big. Like, this is, like, at a time when movies were still relatively young. Even by 1930, there were still probably people alive who remembered life before movies, so... This is still a new art form, but he was the first guy that really arrived on the scene, and he was known everywhere. Because of the silent era, you could play his movies anywhere, whether you're in America or Europe or Africa or Asia. Like, all you needed was to change a few intertitles. Yeah, language intertitles, and boom. And I think that just shows he had that much influence. Like, I believe it's been a while since I've seen the Chaplin Downey Jr. movie, but I believe he built his own studio. He built everything by himself. He just had so much control.
The reason this movie was so expensive is because he kept the cast and crew on standby for 22 months, even though he actually only shot for 179 days. That's a control freak.
That is a control freak.
They also said he enjoyed acting out everything. So when they were doing the scene with the kid with the pea shooter, you know, he would show what he was going to be doing. Then he'd run over and be the pea shooter and shoot the pea and then go back and do the reaction shot. They said it almost seemed like he would have preferred to have done all of the roles himself.
Yeah, he came. Remember when he came, even before he started becoming a director, like he worked with Max Sennett and everybody in the early days. And that was, you know, we do everything ourselves. We don't, you know, do we have a script? Probably not. That doesn't, we're going to always think.
We'll wing it.
We'll wing it. And you know what? It always worked well. And, you know, he comes from that background.
Now, in my class, I use the Chaplin, the Attenborough movie about Chaplin with Robert Downey Jr. in it, to show that scene where they're having this whole argument about talkies. And he says, well, what is the tramp going to say? You know, I mean, if he says anything in English, you've just alienated everybody else in the world who just doesn't speak English. He doesn't speak. And he just holds the line saying it would just be too disappointing to have him actually say something. He's not going to sound like what you think he's supposed to sound like. And he makes a really good case for that. So, and I don't think it, I don't want the tramp to speak, do you?
No, not at all. And that's why even you see The Great Dictator, how that person is a different character. Yeah, he might have the same mannerisms. He may even look a little bit similar in some cases, but he's still a different character. And I think that's why I like that movie, where he doesn't just, I'm going to do the tramp, and the tramp gets mistaken for, you know, this dictator who was supposed to be Hitler. Like, he does something a little bit different, where he still makes the tramp the own, that person from the silent era who never spoke.
Actually, another one of my favorite scenes from the Chaplin biography with Robert Downey Jr. in it is when Kevin Kline's character, who is
Douglas Fairbanks.
Yes, Douglas Fairbanks, says to him about The Great Dictator, because he's going to make that movie. He says, you know, Hitler, have you seen that mustache? Yeah, he stole your act.
You know, it's all this talk about the silent movie. It's really interesting how, like, nowadays we take talkie pictures for granted. Like, how could they not see how big of a thing this was? But when The Jazz Singer first came out in 1927, which, by the way, is not a very good movie. But anyway, when that came out, people were, even you see that in something like Singing in the Rain, where everybody's like, oh, this will never take off. This is dumb. Why would they want to hear people talk? These are the movies. They're always supposed to meant to be silent. Chaplin is one of those few stars from that silent era who were able to really transition well into the talkie era and still have a long career. Like a lot of other people, once the talkies ended, their career just, you know, went down.
Yeah, well, they kind of show that in the Singing in the Rain, that sometimes the people, you don't want them talking because their voice is not pleasing. You know, that's a whole other area of casting that they didn't have to consider. But yeah, I think since Chaplin was so early on the scene, he kind of wrote the script for what movies were going to be. And then when things changed, he had to, you know, get with the modern age.
Yeah, and it was so funny because at the very beginning of this movie, he kind of tells you a little bit what he thinks about talking pictures with the and even like when the guy's talking and the woman, like, the pitch is higher, like it's really funny. Like,
it is.
And even like how he's able to use the sound in his next movie, Modern Times, when there are little parts of it where people are talking, like, he's still able to make it a silent movie, but still in a way have some sort of, you know, dialogue, whether it's mocking talking pictures or just having actual dialogue in his movies.
Yeah. Well, in a way, it boils down to the fact that at his heart, he's a clown. So he needs to be able to be very physical. The comedy has to be very physical, which works really great with silent film because everything has to be sort of overly melodramatic.
Yeah. And talking about the melodramatics, I always wonder, because I imagine you've shown silent movies to your classes. I always wonder how, like, the modern audience reacts to silent movies, because one of the things I can see people complain, like, they're overacting too much. Like, even, like, it works more in, like, this movie, which is a comedy, or, like, you know, a Keaton or a Harold Lloyd or any of that stuff, because it's a comedy, it's supposed to be goofy and over the top, so you can let that pass. But even when you're watching something like, you know, Metropolis or something, people are still, like, you know, hand movements, and they're going like this, and I just wonder how people would react if they find that too cheesy and that would take them out of the movie for a modern audience.
You know, honestly, I think you've hit on something by mentioning the comedy, is because, like I said, I think they feel like what we're now used to from comics and cartoons. So I think that still resonates with people, because that still works in cartoons. But when you're talking about drama, it does get a little more difficult to maintain mm-hmm. the interest because you're expecting more
subtle acting.
Yeah, you are. The other movie that I show consistently in my classes that's silent is The Great Train Robbery.
Oh yeah, the very first film, one of the very first films.
Yeah. So it's innovative in that, you know, they tried to color it and, you know, they tried to cut between two parallel action sequences, which at the time they didn't know if people would get lost, mm-hmm. And they didn't. So it's a good movie to watch for lots of historical reasons. The quality of it is almost not important. I mean, everybody laughs about the body being thrown off of the train. That's obviously a stuffed dummy.
Yeah. Which they did even at this time. They were still throwing dummies off like rivers and stuff. And one of the things that was the ending, I know some people talk about this, is that the blind girl might not exactly be happy. Because she was building up this whole time that this is this wealthy, handsome, rich guy who did this great thing for her. And so when she finds him, that they're going to have this happy life together. And then, you know, she finds out that he's this tramp. And he says, you can see now. She says, yes, I can see now. And a tear rolls down her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily think this, but some people say that it's the tear of just disappointment that this isn't, you know, this prince and, you know, mm-hmm. in a white horse. I think it's more that she's realizing how much the guy did, where mm-hmm. he's this, you know, this tramp, and he, you know, basically was able to do this whole thing for her, even though he had no money or anything to his name.
Yeah, I think it's both. I think it's one, giving up the idea that she had of that this guy was going to come back and the image she had of him. And then it is, I think, a hit in the gut to realize this guy couldn't afford to help me. You know, mm-hmm. what must he done? What a really great person. And yet I'm standing here feeling disappointed. I think it sums up that conflict really well. And also mm-hmm. I love the restraint he has in his expression because he's obviously really excited to see her again.
Yeah.
Because nothing's changed for him. Mm-mm. Everything's exactly the same for him. So, yeah, you wonder what happens in the next scene.
He's, you know, like you said, this perfect restraint where he's just not going over abundance mm-hmm. with emotion. He just has the smile on his face, and he's just like almost like he's trying to contain his, you know, happiness or his joy or his sadness at seeing her.
But he also, he looks a little embarrassed, you know, but mm-hmm. but he doesn't overplay that either. So he's not apologetic because he's got nothing to apologize for. But you know he's not standing there thinking, as soon as she recognizes me, it's all going to be great. Mm-mm. As soon as she recognizes me, then we have to find out what she thinks after that. Yeah, it's a wonderful ending.
Yeah, I think it's the fact that she still, you know, has this love of him, even though she's a bit disappointed. She's not what she built him out to be, but she's still, I think, realizing, like you said, what this guy went through. I think she still accepts it anyway.
Yeah. Now, ironically, they didn't get along.
Mm-hmm.
At all. In fact, he fired her and then wanted to put Georgia Hale in. They actually filmed that ending sequence with Georgia Hale. And then he realized he mm-hmm. didn't have the money to redo all the scenes with Georgia Hale. So they tried to get Virginia Terrell back. And she said, okay, but for twice the money. And he had to give it to her.
And looking at her career, like, this is pretty much the only thing she's ever done. I looked, like, she might have done a couple other films, but nothing really noticeable. So it's interesting that, you know, this is one of the all-time great movies, and this is it for her.
Yeah, that is interesting when that happens that way.
Mm-hmm. And in Georgia Hale, wasn't she in the Gold,
Gold Rush?
Got it. Okay. I was wondering.
There was also another actress he was considering who was 16, and they told him, no, we're not doing that either.
Yeah, that's another thing with Chaplin. If you really look, he had a bit of a problem with underage girls.
You know, in the movie Chaplin that Attenborough does, it kind of explains that.
Yeah, we're...
He falls in love young, and she dies. So his torch is, you know, for somebody he loved when she was young and he was too.
Yeah, and all the biographies I've read about Chaplin, that's sort of what everybody says, that he was looking for that girl. And because it even explained the Attenborough thing, that he found out later that she died during mm-hmm. the influenza outbreak, and that just like tore him apart.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking moment in that movie too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they have the same actress play her as plays Una Chaplin in the end.
Yeah.
So it pulls that together, that mm-hmm. that idea.
Yeah. An interesting little tidbit. Una O'Neill, which was his wife, and Una became Una Chaplin, their granddaughter, whose name is also Una Chaplin, was in the first seasons 2 and 3 of Game of Thrones. She was the wife of Robb Stark, who gets killed during the Red Wedding.
No way! Yep, yep. Oh my God, I'm going to have to go back and look at that.
One of the things interesting reading about this, Kubrick said something interesting about Chaplin, that he compared the way he shot the films, as he said, like to the way they shoot I Love Lucy. He said that they're shot very simple and non-cinematically, like there's nothing really that stands out. And I agree. But then again, you can be a good director and not like set up great shots. Like Chaplin was all about the story and the performances. Mm-hmm. Camera, just make sure everything's in frame and in focus. Good enough.
Well, also, we're talking about the beginning days of film, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, people weren't expecting you to be that tricksy. No. They were expecting you to set up the camera and then do something really cool in front of it.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's a little bit harsh. I mean, he does make a good point, but, you know, once again, not everything has to be, you know, long takes in the Overlook Hotel, Stanley. You know, you can just,
right.
You can do something where it's just, you can direct
minimalist.
Performance.
Yeah, yes, exactly. The performance, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's all about the performance because he's trying to direct mm-hmm. himself. He oh, doesn't yeah. want any distractions.
Yeah, and just once again, you said he's not only the director, but once again, he's the director. He wrote the story. I'm pretty sure he produced it. And one thing we didn't really talk about yet is he composed the music.
Yes, and also some other music like Smile, a really famous mm-hmm. song.
I think he's really underrated as a composer. And once again, I've never, when it comes to Chaplin, I don't think there's ever been somebody, even nowadays, like still 100 years after Chaplin, I don't think anybody's done as much for in films as he has. The closest person I can think of is like Eastwood. Eastwood's composed a few scores, or he's written some music for his films. Of course, he's acted and directed and sometimes written. But I don't think anybody's really just done so much as Chaplin. He's really good as a composer. It's not just forgettable music.
He also, with Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks, started United Artists,
yeah.
which was radical in its time because they were talking about the inmates running the asylum because they were used to that model where, you know, some studio head owned all of the people working for them and moved them around like chess pieces. So it was very controversial at the time. And I like to bring this up in my class, too. Guess who owns United Artists now?
I'm curious. Who?
Tom Cruise.
Now talk about lunatics running the asylum.
Well, it's just an interesting arc, you know, when you think mm-hmm. about it. You know, you start off saying these silent film stars decided to, you know, start their own production company. And that, at the time, was really iconic. And then you think, and then years and years and years pass, where'd it go? Tom mm-hmm. Cruise.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the actors don't have to go through Dianetics or something. So. But anyway, we're going to talk about we could talk about a little bit more about other silent movie stars, because as much as I do enjoy Chaplin, he's one of my favorites. I got a lot of his stuff, seen pretty much everything that's really important of his work. I will say I like Buster Keaton better. And they're two different styles. Keaton is more just, he's pure comedy. His story, mm-hmm. you know, the
he's
story
funnier.
Is funnier, and I would say. And just what, and I would say Chaplin, while a physical comedian, definitely, there's nothing that when I'm watching his movie, I'm going, how in the world did he pull that off?
Mm-hmm.
With Keaton, you're just constantly like, my God, what is he? How did he pull that off? Like, how did he not, like, die at this moment? And I think that's why I always enjoyed Keaton, just because even today, like, the closest person I could think of to a Keaton is Jackie Chan, but maybe not even just something. I think Keaton just is a pure, I've never seen somebody as an action comedian star than him.
I think of Jim Carrey and Steve Martin as examples of guys who are very physical in their comedy, mm-hmm. who do a lot of things with their face and their body to get the joke across, which would have been great in the silent film era.
Yeah. And those guys are great. But the thing is, I would say is, like, they don't necessarily do the stunts Keaton did. Like, remember one of the stories Keaton said when he's talking to his doctor, he was like, did you know that you had your ribs broken right here? And he goes, no, I did not at all. And then Keaton actually starts like showing him off his war wounds. Like, okay, this bruise I got here from this movie, this bruise I got here from this movie. And I just, while don't get me wrong, I love Steve Martin and Jim Carrey. They don't really, I've never seen him do crazy stunts like the famous scene in Steamboat Bill when the house is falling down And, you know, he falls right on the one opening that wouldn't crush him to death, which he actually did that. And people who were filming it closed their eyes because if he was like a slightest inch off, he would have been dead.
Yeah, he's an incredible comedian, Buster Keaton. And I agree with you. His movies, I think, are a little more accessible than Chaplin's because Chaplin does try to get some pathos in his movies. You know, some moments make you think or aren't quite happy.
Yeah, especially like, you know, Great Dictator, which, you know, is a very progressive film for its time because this was still at a time when the U.S. didn't want to get involved in World War II. And here's a movie that's directly taking on Hitler. That's a great movie. And even Limelight is a really good movie, one of his last films. And that's like a movie really looking back at his career.
And The Circus and The Gold Rush. I mean, most of the stuff that he did has some moments where there's something serious in there with all the jokes. And where even Buster Keaton was just pure comedian. Yeah,
and even The Kid, too.
And even The Kid, too.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess we talk a little bit more about silent movies. So we've talked a lot about, you know, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin. Other movies, like more dramatic ones that you would recommend? I mean, I imagine at some point in your film class you talk about German Expressionism, so like Nosferatu, Caligari.
Yes, I use The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari in my World Cinema class. And, you know, occasionally I'll bring up something like The Artist. But The Artist was sort of a fluke, I think. I mean, I don't think you could make another movie like The Artist and get the same interest generated. It was kind of like, wow, isn't that interesting because it's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think The Artist gets a little bit of a bad rap. I know it won Best Picture, but a lot of people say, oh, it's going to be one of those movies that you go, oh, what's that movie? Oh, it won Best Picture? I don't even remember that. And I think, you know, that was a very good movie, and I enjoyed it. I don't think it deserves the bad rap it's gotten the last couple of years.
You know, it's kind of like musicals. You can bring them back every now and then, but you have to be very judicious about what you pick, because otherwise people are like, not another musical. Mm-hmm. Or I'd go see it, but I don't want to see a musical.
Yeah, not another somebody trying to do a silent movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think there has to be a story reason why you do it that way anyway. I don't think you need to force it into a silent film because I don't think that would work. Yeah. And they're not silent anyway. It just means there's no dialogue. Yeah. There's always plenty of music.
Okay, so getting closer to my questions here. Is there anything else you want to talk about, Charlie Chaplin or City Lights or silent movies?
Is this your favorite Charlie Chaplin movie? I don't know if I asked you that.
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, Gold Rush comes really close, so does Modern Times or even Great Dictator, but this one probably just sticks out just a tiny bit more.
Now, I do have some interesting facts. One is that Winston Churchill visited the set, and Charlie Chaplin took a break to make a short film with him. I would love to see that.
Oh, I want to find that now.
Yeah, see, that's an interesting fact. Also, everybody in this movie has been dead since 2007.
Now, who was the last person?
Now that's a tricky question. I don't know. He also invited Albert Einstein and his wife to join him at the Los Angeles premiere. And he said when the house lights came up that Einstein had teared up at that ending. And he was surprised because he didn't know that Einstein was that sentimental. But what a career where, you know, Winston Churchill rolls on by to see you do your thing. And then Albert Einstein sits next to you and cries.
He was the very first movie star. And like international movie star, I should say. And I don't think we'll ever see somebody get to that level, at least for me, just because he was the first. And he was everybody could get into his movies and not have to deal with things like subtitles. And I just like that's so fascinating to me just because this guy was like the king of the world. Everybody in the world knew who he was.
Yeah, not only because he didn't have subtitles could everybody understand the movies, but he stuck with universal experiences. So it doesn't matter what part of the world you're from, everybody understands the feelings that he expresses in the movies, and that's why they worked.
Yep. It could be any that's like there's he's never specifies what city or country he's in. Like even the Great Dictator, the countries are made up names, even though it's specifically like Germany and Europe. Okay, then last question I'll have is tell us a little bit about your classes.
This semester I am teaching World Cinema, American Cinema, and Intro to Film. In the summer I will be teaching American Cinema Online. And I will be teaching those three courses again in the fall, and also film and philosophy.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing Charlie Chaplin, his 1931 classic, City Lights. Don't forget, you can listen to the Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Rest of Westhave, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, yes, I can see now.